Yes, I have been a curate here for 10 years. I find the key to remaining as a curate is incompetence. You just don't get promoted. I always knew the Church of England was for me ever since I got a third at university. When I got my third, I said, was I close to a 2-2? My tutor said, no, Rico, it's a very solid third. So I knew that was a calling to become an Anglican clergyman, so here I am. And one of the things I find about being a clergyman is that you get asked often to take the funerals or memorial services of close family friends, and that has recently happened to me. I've been asked to take a memorial service of a friend of my father's who is a close friend. But interestingly, as a clergyman, the one question I won't be allowed to ask at that service, or there'd be dreadful embarrassment, is this question. Was the dear person in question right with God? In right relationship with the God who made them? Now, this man was always charming to me, delightful. He was a great friend to my father, and my father has been grieving his loss deeply. But I have to say, as I look back, I don't think this man ever gave any mind time to the things of God in his life. I really don't. He'd never have made time as you have to come today, so thank you very much for coming. And in that sense, he was very unlike the two men we have before us in this passage, because actually, Luke 18 that Jago read, because actually both these men did believe that being in right relationship with God was important. In other words, they did believe there was a judgment. There was a day of accounting when God would say, well, were we in right relationship or not? And it's not just those men that believed it. I've just read the Johnny Wilkinson book. I don't know if you read this. By the way, there are only two things in life as far as I can work out, rugby and theology. And I've just read this book. And Wilkinson says in this book, I live my life as if a 24-hour surveillance camera is trained on me. At the end of my days, I'll have to hand over the video and sign it off. And he's talking about relating to a God who is his judge. I don't know what you make of that. I'm in the habit of trying to read the Bible each morning. Recently, actually, there's a clergyman here at John Stott, at All Souls, who's been here 50 years, called John Stott. He gets up at 10 to 5 in the morning to read his Bible, has half an hour sleep in the afternoon, and I've adopted one of those two habits. But I'm in the habit of trying to read the Bible in the morning, and I recently read these words from Amos 8, verse 7. The Lord has sworn, I'll never forget anything you've done. Never forget that. And I guess what I'm talking about as I talk about those things is guilt. These guys had a sense of guilt, and they saw it as a warning signal. We get that from the last verse of the passage. If you can see, I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified. There was a sense of, in them, you know, at the end of our lives, there's going to be a law court setting, and how are we going to be in relationship with God? And I think that it's guilt that often flashes this up, and I can tell you something about guilt. You can try and erase it. You can try and blame it on social conditioning. You can try and get yourself reprogrammed in therapy, and often there's false guilt around. You can try and blame it on your parents or your circumstances, but unless you're very different from me, surely you've found that guilt is real. It is a reality. We feel guilty because we are responsible human beings. There's a classic moment in this film, The Talented Mr. Ripley, in which Matt Damon, playing Tom Ripley, suddenly confesses to his lover, don't you just take the past and put it in a room in the basement and lock the door and never go there? That's what I do. Take the past, put it in a room in the basement, lock the door, never go there. And then you meet someone special and all you want to do is toss them the key and say, open up, step inside. I keep wanting to do that. Fling the door open, just let the light in, clean everything. But you can't because it's dark and there are demons, and if anybody saw how ugly it is. And he stops speaking. And chillingly later he laments, I'm lost, I'm going to be stuck in the basement alone and in the dark. And both these two men wanted their consciences cleansed. And so in order for that to happen, can we see in the passage, they both do two things. Verse 10, they went up to the temple to pray. Verse 14, they went home. And the reason they went to the temple is that's where you found relationship with God in ancient Israel. That's where you were in contact with God. And Jesus then picks two men who are at the far extremes of society. And it's as though he holds up a mirror and he says, actually, as I hold up these two, I'm actually asking where your walk on part is. That's the great thing about the parables of Jesus, by the way. So often we have a part to play. And he's saying at this point, he's saying, well, that's what these two men are doing with their guilt. What are you doing with yours? That's what he's sort of saying. as he holds up the mirror. And the first man at the one end of the spectrum is this Pharisee, and they were the separated ones. They were absolutely sickened by the religious professionals of their day. They were a lay movement who said, we are going to get it right in terms of relating to God. And so they were trying to be perfect in law keeping, and in terms of religious obedience, they played for keeps, these guys. At the other end of the spectrum, the other end, if you like, in the mirror, is this tax collector who is an agent of the Roman occupying army. And of course, what happens is you've got flat franchises from the governor, and you were told to raise up to a certain level of taxes, and then you could raise as much else as you liked and fleece your own people. And they were hated for that, but more than that, they were hated because religiously they were seen to accept another ruler in Israel apart from God. And that, for the rest of Israel, was unacceptable. I mean, the Romans were there, but they never really accepted they were there. That was what was going on culturally. And to just put this in place, for them to work for the Roman occupying power was a bit like a French mayor in World War II getting rich on Nazi bribes by informing on the resistance. That was actually the level of emotion that was conjured up by what they did. So they both go up to the temple to pray. They both know they need to be right with God. They both know that guilt is a reality. And the extraordinary thing is only one of them prays, and only one of them, verse 14, comes home justified. And the really interesting thing in this story, of course, is how could the Pharisee, the moral religious man, have got it so wrong? Because Jesus here totally disorientates us. I mean, surely he was a good man, a decent man. As a vicar in the Shires would say, you know, he never harmed a fly. Delightful man. Surely that's the case. God's bound to be pleased with him, isn't he? Look at his performance. And the question is, how could this religious man have got it so wrong, and here's what's extraordinary and offensive, and go home on the way to hell, not on the way to heaven, not justified, not right with God? Well, as we look, can we see, the key is verse 9, and then we'll unpack it. But verse 9, to some who were confident of their own righteousness. And the question here is, as we look at the thinking of this Pharisee, is why will religion always take me to hell? Why will it never put me right with God? And Jesus gives two major reasons here. They're in verse 9, but they're unpacked later on. And I want to just talk about, number one, can we see the point down there? A false confidence, verse 11. The Pharisee stood up and prayed about himself. God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. And the text literally says that the Pharisee took up his position, and it's almost not that he prayed about himself, but he prayed to himself, and he stood up, you see, with his palms open, standing up. This was how they would have prayed, in the religious robes, and he would have been there to receive God's blessing on himself. It was very visible. He was being religious. And the key thing is, if you look down, I put it in the footnote, that he was literally praying to himself. So his focus wasn't God, it was himself, and you can see that in what he says. Can you see, God, I thank you that I'm not like other men. I fast twice a week, I give a tenth of all I get. Actually, his prayer is incredibly self-centered. It's all on his own performance. Self-centered people are such a pain, aren't they, don't you find? Samuel Butler wrote about two very selfish people called Mr. and Mrs. Carlyle, and he said, how good of God to cause Carlyle and Mrs. Carlyle to marry each other and so make two people miserable instead of four. You can relate to that. And this fellow's exalting himself. That's the thing. Verse 14, can we see everyone who exalts himself? He's puffed up with spiritual pride. This is little Jack Horner religion. He put in his thumb and pulled out a plum and said, what a good boy am I. And actually, even verse 12, he's into bonus points. Can we see verse 12? I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get. Now actually, the law demanded that you fast once a year on the Day of Atonement. And he says, I fast 103 times more than that is required. And I know some of you are thinking, Enrico, you could get onto that as well, this fasting malarkey. You know, last year I gave up puddings except on my day off. And then, my New Year's resolution, on my day off, I had six. It was a disaster. And furthermore, you see, he also, when it comes to garden herbs, he's meant to be a consumer, but he says, actually, I'll be a producer for the temple. He's into his own performance. And he exalts himself. And here's the issue. As he comes to stand before his Creator, there is no humility. Actually, God, you're very, very fortunate to have me. very fortunate to have me as he does his self-justification. God, don't you realize I'm being very generous? I'm doing a great deal for you. And if I may say, there's a certain emotion here. This was exactly how my maternal grandmother died. I just remember her dying, saying, God will be very, very pleased to have me because I'm a good person. So there is, first of all, a false confidence. But secondly, there's a false comparison. Can you see what he does to lift himself up? And sadly, sickeningly, this is always what religious people do if they haven't got the Christian faith sorted out. And I'm sure some of you have experienced this, and I want to apologize for it profoundly as a clergyman if this has happened to you. But you see what he does. In order to lift himself up and to sort out his guilt, what's in his basement, he does a comparison on other people. So he says, it's not about me, Lord. Look at them and guess what's in their basement. That's what he's doing. Do you see what he does as we look down? Can we see? He stood up, verse 11, prayed about himself. God, I thank you that I am not like other men. Not in my basement. Robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. Do you see? In his desire to self-justify himself, he despises others. He despises them. And his focus is away from himself as he snarls, for example, at this tax collector and says, and what's he doing cluttering up the place? I must be okay. Look at the rest of them. Look at the people on the telly. At least I'm not like them. And you see, that's what's going on here. So he says, you see, God, here is religion and here am I, and you will accept me on my terms. I'll drive the bargain. I'll buy you off. And you see, here's the issue. Jesus says, actually, religion is not about meeting God on our terms. It's about meeting God on his terms because he's the creator. And so we move, as we come to a close now, from a false confidence and a false comparison. And I hope that I've raised some issues there in terms of how you viewed stuff, to a famous contrast. And now we come to the heart of the Christian faith. And if you've never understood this, you've never understood it. You see, the Christian faith, wonderfully at heart, is not about what I must do, a two-letter word. It's about, amazingly, what God has done, a four-letter word. And therefore, it is this wonderful experience of thanksgiving. And thankful people are happy people. But there's this wonderful thanksgiving, and can we see this fantastic contrast here, verse 13, in this tax collector. But verse 13, the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. So he says, actually, as I come to you, God, I want to relate to you as you see me. And the word a sinner, actually, in the translation, it's more the sinner. So he says, God, if you want to see a specimen of human rebellion against you, if you want to see someone who actually has shaken his fist at you, who has not lived as he should, who has not loved other people as he should, who has taken the gifts, fun, family, friends, falling in love, food, fitness, but pushed you away, and who indeed has got a basement that is full of stuff of which I am thoroughly ashamed, and furthermore, God, I know you know all about it. If you want to see a specimen of that, God, then it's me. I'm the sinner. And you see, actually, it's in his body language. Because whilst the Pharisee stands and holds her palms outstretched and says, well, here I am, Lord, aren't you delighted to have me? He, can we see in verse 13, beat his breast, has his head down, and he says, God, I am just so sorry about this. Have mercy on me. He knew how God viewed him. And what's amazing here, this is what is so striking, is do you know that the first step to being right with God is to realize that I'm not. That's the irony here. When I was at school, I kept this diary because I thought I was such a great bloke. I owed it to the world record my life. And I found as I kept it, I was cornered by my conscience, and it was a profoundly depressing 6 months as I kept it. But actually, what I later found out was, actually, as I sat there and said, Rico, this is not good, I was getting on the road to relationship with God. So in the Christian faith, the amazing thing is, the only way up is down. The only way up is down. It's when I start saying, God, what is your opinion of me? I'm not going to delude myself. I'm not going to try and hide from my guilt. The Bishop of London has said, we make no spiritual progress until we look within to the basement and take responsibility for what we see. And amazingly, you see, as he looks up to the altar, he would have seen, and this is the key, and as he asks for mercy, which means, literally, mercy means, as he asked to have God's anger turned away for what he'd rightfully done wrong, what he had done wrong is he looked up, he saw the blood from the animal sacrifices actually dripping down the altar. He'd have seen it. And later in Luke chapter 18, Jesus says, I have to go to Jerusalem to die because I am the one whose blood must be shed. You see, an animal would be taken once a year on the Day of Atonement, and a family would go up with an unblemished lamb to the temple, and the priest would lay his hands on the head of the lamb, and then it would be killed, an unblemished lamb. And when a little girl wept into her mother's skirts and said, Mummy, why did that have to happen? Why did the lamb have to die? She would be told, you deserve to die for your wrongdoing, but amazingly, God has provided a substitute in your place. And as the priest lays his hands on its head, all our sin, all our wrongdoing, everything that's in our basement, the thing that we're most ashamed of, gets laid on this little lamb. And then it dies. And as he looked up and said, have mercy on me, a sinner, he'd have seen the blood running down. And my question as I finish now is, what are you doing with the blood of the Lord Jesus Christ? Have you ever thought about it and what it means? Do you just see it as blood, a Galilean carpenter dying, or do you say, no, actually, that blood was shed so that in death and blood my wrongdoing could be paid for? And if you understand that mercy, can I say the Christian faith becomes overwhelmingly joyful, for there's this wonderful gift of forgiveness. So just to put in place where you're at it, and I guess particularly as I've got to take this memorial service, let me finish with this question. It's a tough question, but it's one as a clergyman I often will want to ask at some point. If you were to die tonight and God said, why shall I let you into heaven, what would you reply? Can you see the reply of the Pharisee? Well, all his confidence is in verse 9, his own righteousness. So he'd say, this Pharisee, look, I'm not greedy, dishonest, immoral, I fast twice a week, I give a tenth of my income. Because of my performance, God, you accept me. And then, if you were to die tonight, and God said, why shall I let you into heaven, what about this tax collector? He'd say, Lord, accept me because you're merciful and because this blood has been shed for my forgiveness. And I guess the question for all of us then, as we go forward and as we look for peace for our souls, and as we long for forgiveness, and as we know that guilt is a reality, is, again, what will you do with the blood? What will you do with it? And once you get inside that, you're right at the heart of the Christian faith. And if you haven't really got hold of it and what it means, then we long for you to be able to do that.